I'm David Brown, and this is Business Wars. Today, we conclude our series, The North Face versus Patagonia. What started out as two self-described dirtbags trying to turn a love of the outdoors into their own respective business ventures ended up taking a surprising turn into the mainstream world of apparel. One of the key players in this story is Hap Klopp, who in 1968 purchased a then-burgeoning outdoor sports equipment store called The North Face. The company was sold for the bargain basement price of $60,000. Klopp was CEO of the North Face for the next 20 years and turned the small chain of Bay Area stores into a multi-million dollar business. Today, the North Face is a global brand that can be found in 5,000 stores across 50 countries. Part of Klopp's success was brought on by innovation. He helped develop the first geodesic dome tent, which took the nation by storm. He also had a huge role in boosting the popularity of cross-country skiing, a tactic to encourage people to buy outdoor gear in the hiking off-season. Not a bad idea. As someone who was there in the early days of both Patagonia and the North Face, Klopp can personally attest to the challenges of bringing a niche brand into the spotlight of the mainstream consumer. Perhaps one of the biggest challenges of any brand, especially one that celebrates the outdoors, is to make products that don't harm the environment. These days, the North Face has stated that it's committed to sustainability, using fabrics that are meant to save water and reduce the use of chemicals. So, what was the journey like to become one of the biggest outdoor apparel brands? And in this cutthroat business world, what were the advantages of Klopp's friendly relationship with Patagonia founder Yvon Chouinard? We'll hear some answers and a whole lot more when we chat with our next guest, businessman and adventurer, Hap Klopp. It's coming up next.
If you travel for work, you know to pack two suits, business and swim. You know with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you-know-business.
Tools and Weapons is a podcast exploring the promise and the peril of the digital age, hosted by Microsoft's vice chair and president, Brad Smith. His latest guest is Bayer CEO Bill Anderson. Though many of us know Bayer for its pharmaceuticals, they're also focused on crop science with the goal of making sure no one on planet Earth goes hungry. On Tools and Weapons, Brad and Bill talk about how the German company is using artificial intelligence paired with CRISPR technology to increase food production without fertilizers. Their efforts put AI and digital tools in the hands of farmers to get the most out of every acre on a hotter, more crowded planet. It's the latest conversation in a series that invites listeners to pull up a front row seat to some of the most important developments in technology today. You can check out this episode and a whole lot more of Tools and Weapons with Brad Smith wherever you get your podcasts. Hap Klopp, welcome to Business Wars.
Nice to be here.
Before we get into your role in the North Face, I want to hear a little bit more about your entrepreneurial spirit. I know that when you became the owner of the North Face, you had already had a little bit of practice in the business world, right?
That is correct. I had an MBA background from Stanford, and while I was an undergraduate, I ended up running a family company that made wood products because my father passed away, and I was going back and forth between Stanford and Spokane, Washington.
Yeah. So how did you wind up with a company like the North Face? Was this something that you had a passion for?
You know, I decided that I wanted to run a company, and I had a lot of idiosyncratic ideas, none of which really fit into the business world. I believe in sustainability. I believe that there shouldn't be any discrimination against people because of their gender or sexual preference or whatever. I didn't believe that people should have a problem if they were an immigrant. So I looked at a lot of large companies, and one, they weren't entrepreneurial enough for me. Two, they didn't have a lot of those ideas. So I finally decided if I couldn't work for anybody else, what I needed to do was start a company of my own around something I knew and something I cared about. And when you're raised in Spokane, Washington, what you do for entertainment is generally go outdoors. I had a pretty good idea of what a good product was and what product was needed. And as a result of it, I developed a philosophy around that. This is in 1966, 67, 68. I was looking at a world which I didn't like. I didn't like all the urban degradation that was fighting over the Vietnam War. And I knew, I believed that there was going to be a movement to the wilderness and that there was a business opportunity there as well as a world-changing opportunity.
I wonder if there wasn't something about the way that the North Face came about in the first place that made it perfect for what you were looking for. I mean, you were talking about, you know, how your ideas, your values, you know, values-centered business. You think about the early days of the North Face, how they got started, how you had an outdoor industry such as it was that was very much run by people with ambition to make enough cash to fund their next expedition, right? I mean, it was a very sort of organic thing. You weren't trying to make massive amounts of money. But I can't help but think that when you took it over, that you had a bigger vision for how the North Face could be, well, huge. Or am I wrong about that?
Well, I don't think the word huge cropped into our thinking, but it was larger than what was being done then. When I first got into the business, what I saw was a chance to disrupt the business that existed out there. Mm-hmm. I recognized that a lot of the products I was using and other people were using really were not the state of the art. And so very simply, what we did was disrupt the product cycle by introducing advanced materials to the camping world. And we took aircraft aluminum and made tent poles and pack frames out of it. We took parachute cloth and we made sleeping bags, tent tops, and some really funky clothing. And what we did is lighten the load of what people carried by about 50%. We're making it available to masses of people, including women. And as a result, it was an inflection point for really moving into the future.
Now forgive me for interrupting, but I want to get back to a word that you used where you're talking about disrupting things. And as you know, that's a real big buzzword right now, being a disruptor. When you took over at the North Face, were you using that concept of being a disruptor then? Or, I mean, especially since it's become sort of something that a lot of people talk loosely about nowadays, were you thinking about disrupting the market, or were you thinking, no, we're just going to make a, you know, to use the old-fashioned terminology, better mousetraps?
No, we actually had an idea. I believed in building a brand. I believe that establishing a brand was a key for a longevity for a company and annuity for the future. And it was one that was shorthand for all of the ideas we had. Mm. And the way I did that and the way we did it over the years is we established three words that were key to building our brand that had to be applied, whether it was with customers or suppliers or with employees or whatever, all were touched in the same way. One of those three words was disruption. And the second one was quality. And the third one was triple bottom line, which really referred to an equal emphasis on profits, on society, on the environment. In product, the disruption was also in our business model. We were omnichannel from day one, which was heresy in that time. You sold your own product, you sold to other people, you sold in catalogs, you sold in retail stores. Nobody had done that. Now it's pretty much the standard of the day, but we were disruptive that way. And we were disruptive in terms of our concept of a lifelong product. We guaranteed, with a warranty, a lifelong product. Nobody was doing that. So we were disruptive across every aspect of what we did.
Really interesting. You're talking about some of those innovations. Let's focus a little bit on one that I think a lot of our listeners may find it hard to imagine the world without, and that's the geodesic dome-shaped tent, right? I mean, this was copied by everyone. You guys were the innovators. Do you remember when that idea first came about and when that design took off for you?
Yes, I'm actually not so old that I forget these things.
Didn't mean to suggest such a thing.
I had I'd known Buckminster Fuller for a while through an introduction with one of my classmates at Stanford University. Buckminster Fuller was this philosopher genius that had ideas to change the world, everything from an entirely new math to the construction of geodesic structures. And so our sales had slowed down intent. And so I went to Bucky and I said, Bucky, you said that your geodesic structure encompasses the maximum amount of space with a minimum amount of materials. Mm-hmm. And I said, that sounds like it could be a backpacking tent. And he said, well, it very well could be. So we put a team together and then we worked with him for a period of about 18 months, which required innovating new tent poles, new structures, design, ways to put things together. And we built that.
It's like a case study, though. I mean, and there's so many of these case studies. If you look at the history of North Face, there's a point back in 1975 where I gather you're trying to get some quality goose down for the jackets and sleeping bags that North Face was making. Going into that meeting, obviously you didn't know what exactly to expect when you went to China. There were these people who were trading in massive amounts of goose down. You just needed enough to make your small quantity, right?
Well, what happened is that China dominated the production of goose down. They had about 80% of the world's supply because goose down is a byproduct of selling the goose for food. They were selling to middlemen, and because there was a very big imbalance between the demand and the supply, there wasn't enough supply out there. So all the middlemen were basically bastardizing the product that we were getting. And they were using reused bedding down. They were putting in dust and feathers and whatever. And so the quality of the product was going down. One of our key words, one of our key tenets of our company was the highest quality. So we had to make a decision. Were we going to abandon that word or were we going to really live by it? So what we did, we would go directly to China, jump over our suppliers and buy the raw material, which had all sorts of problems with it that were pretty unique. I mean, the first one was there were very few people from the United States that had ever traveled to China. You know, we were probably in the first 20 that had gone
over. Incredible.
The second thing is the U.S. didn't do business with China, so none of the banks in the U.S. would deal with that. So we had to get an intermediary bank.
Right.
And what we had to do was buy the down in a raw state, which meant we were going to have to process it, and we didn't have the facilities to process it. So the people that we were jumping over who did the processing, we were going to somehow have to go back to them if we got the down to have them process it. But I figured if they were going to basically work on the margins to screw us on the down they had out there, they were basically more interested in making money than anything else. So I kind of thought they would do that.
You played a really prominent part in increasing the public's interest in cross-country skiing. That was a really audacious move that you took. I mean, it seems to me, what made you decide to take that sort of risk? I mean, did you feel like you didn't have much to lose, or what was your mindset going into that?
Desperation. Not very many people want to go winter camping when you got beyond the diehards. So we ended up with heavily skewed business towards the summer, and then we had to get through kind of the fallow months in the winter. Well, it seemed logical to us that the people we knew who were backpackers were also skiers, many of them cross-country skiers outdoor. So there were already some examples in Europe, and then one particular one in the U.S., which was the Trapp Family Lodge back in Stowe, Vermont. So one of our people, Dave Harvey, who was working with me, had gone to school with one of the Von Trapps. And what we did is contact him and ask him if he would come out and help us figure out how to set up cross-country skiing in the West, because we thought that would expand our sales and would also serve our customers well. He actually brought a couple of his people with him, who we ended up working with for many years. Jim Speck was one. The other was Ned Gillette. The two of them then helped develop the trails, the breaking the ground that we did. And then we handed off that entire thing that we developed to the Yosemite group,
right, right,
so that they could manage it. We didn't really want to manage it. We just wanted to create it. And then we wanted to build on it. And that's how we did it.
You know, Audible has a brand new collection of exclusive thrillers. Every move is made more exciting by captivating sound design, eerie soundscapes, and dynamic performances. I just downloaded The Grand Opening by Carl Weber. It's a mystery about a family business in a small southern town, and there are secrets around every turn. You know, when I'm listening, the time just disappears, getting completely immersed in the story and the performances. And as an Audible member, you get to keep one title a month from their entire catalog, including bestsellers and new releases. So come on, listen along. New members can try Audible now free for 30 days. Head on over to audible.com/BW or just text BW to 500-500. That's audible.com/BW or text BW to 500-500 to try Audible free for 30 days. As business owners and managers, you use software for your business every day. You use one piece of software to manage your customers, another to manage your employees, another to manage your finances, and the list goes on. You buy these pieces independently and hope they fit neatly together like a puzzle. And then you find out the hard way that they don't, and you end up with a mess at the heart of your business operations. Does any of this sound familiar? Well, fortunately, Zoho offers a solution to this chaos. It's called Zoho One. Zoho One is a suite of around 50 pre-integrated business applications that fit together beautifully. So instead of dealing with disparate software from multiple vendors with multiple contracts and price points, you deal with one vendor with all the pieces of the business software puzzle neatly put together, offered at a very attractive price. Now, if this sounds interesting to you, you got to check out Zoho One at zoho.one. That's Zoho.one. With Zoho, you're not just licensing apps. You're licensing peace of mind. Well, in the late 70s, early 80s, I guess, North Face had already become, it was known for function primarily, but it also sort of began to make a real mark on the fashion scene. Was that intentional? Was that something that you sought for the North Face, or did it just kind of happen as a result of changes in the world?
Most of it just happened, to be very honest. What we believe that basically, if you make a good product, people will find their way to it. We believed that there was a movement to go to the wilderness. We believed that there is a need that people had for a high quality product that lasted forever. We believed that there would be people buying it, not for the fashion movement, but they would be buying it because it was the right thing to do, that there was going to be a shift. There is a reality that it dawned on us that it was happening. And so we started shifting, as did other people, that originally the stores we sold through were primarily located in suburban locations. Yeah. When it started moving more into the fashionable realm, we moved and some others moved our stores into major cities. It was acknowledging that shift that was happening after we sensed that it was happening.
Interesting.
That we would be in front of more of those people.
You and Yvonne Chouinard had talked at one point, I think, about an alliance where the North Face would potentially help provide Patagonia with a place to manufacture products in Scotland. And I don't think that conversation moved forward, but I'm curious about your relationship with Yvonne Chouinard. It was friendly, it seems, and here you were, I mean, in a sense, both combatants for the same general space, right? I mean, how did that work out?
There's two types of thinking, and there was an article in Harvard Business Review about it one time that said there's the pie enlargers and the pie slicers. Mm-hmm. The pie slicers are people who are Malthusian in their thinking, and they think that the size of the pie is finite, so anything that I get, I have to take from you. The pie enlargers are ones that believe that with enough innovation, you're able to create an entirely expanded market, so there's enough for all. And that was the mentality we had. And so the reality is we're always competing with people because we were in that space, but it was a very friendly competition. And so we were all trying to grow, but we didn't think we were taking it from one another. And so that's why, although it never went anywhere, we had the discussion when we decided to go into Scotland, we wanted to get inside the EU so we didn't have to pay the value-added tax, so our prices would be more acceptable. Mm-hmm, and at that time, Patagonia was not yet in there, so they saw the benefit of what we were doing. We were going to have extra capacity because we took over an existing factory that existed in Scotland. And so existing capacity, we know how to make good products. They have good products. We thought we could do it. It didn't evolve from there, but it was an interesting discussion.
In 1988, you decide to sell the company. What went into your decision to leave?
It was an interesting time. We were growing, and in the old model, the one that everybody was using, which was selling through other retailers and having inventory and receivables associated with that, and even some offshore production, which had a long lead time, what you could do is you could only grow 20% a year on internally generated funds. And we were growing 100% a year, which resulted in me having to constantly bring in additional financing, whether it was debt through a bank or whether it was equity through additional investors. And doing that became almost a full-time job. And that isn't what I wanted to do. What I wanted to do was run the business, train people. 11 of the people that started with me at North Face had no business training, but with the training they got in the company and their genius and the fact that they loved the outdoors, they ended up running major companies.
Yeah.
And I wanted to build that. I wanted to educate people that way. I wanted to educate the consumers on going to the wilderness for what they could do. So all of those things were getting less and less of my time. I remember one case where I was invited to go to the Olympics, which were in Canada, and I couldn't go just because I was out trying to raise money. And it just seemed like things were kind of backward at that time. And of course, the more people you bring in terms of equity, the more you're going to have different views. And then you have to worry about taking some people out and then keeping other people in. And then you have to be communicating a whole lot. And so what started out to be a labor of love about an industry I loved was turning me into kind of a poorly paid investment banker. And so at a certain point, one of the board members that had been with me through the whole ride said, you know, he said, Hap, you always said that when it wasn't fun anymore, you were going to leave. He said, it kind of looks like we've reached that point, haven't we? And it was just a lot of friction that I didn't want.
Yeah, yeah. Of course, it must give you a certain sense of pride to see people sporting the North Face logo in all walks of life these days. As you think back on how this company got started and the culture of the company and the way that you took hardships and turned them into explosive opportunities for the company. And can this kind of thing happen today, or did you have to be in a certain sort of economic environment or climate? I mean, is the North Face story, I guess, replicable if someone's listening to you and thinking, wow, well, that was a 60s thing. You know, that's you couldn't get an assemblage of these kinds of people with this kind of, you know, values structure and big ideas. It's not practical today. What would you say to them?
Oh, I think it is. When I started out, there was mountaineering, which is big mountaineering, a little bit of rock climbing that exists there, and you know, kind of downhill skiing or whatever. Then it evolved into the fact that there was ice climbing that developed. There was gym climbing that developed out of that. In addition to mountaineering, there was bouldering that happened that people did in terms of all of it. Each one of those is a subset of the existing business that has its own devotees in it. If you look at the gym climbing business right now, highly successful entrepreneurs running a number of gyms across the country that didn't exist then. So even within the segment we're in, there is that opportunity. And as new businesses start up, there is that opportunity. Now, we were very lucky because the main thread of what was driving all of that, which ended up being sort of backpacking and going back to the wilderness, was the one we hung on to. So we might have had the largest segment that was there. And the fact that that became a popular concept for fashion doubled what was going to happen there. You know, we didn't expect the companies to be the size they are right now. I mean, if you look at North Face, it's almost $3 billion in turnover. You look at Patagonia, it's probably $1.5 million. It's $2 million at Columbia. I think we all at the outset would have been very happy with the type of numbers we had when they sold, which was $150 million or so. You know, that we thought that was huge. And now they've added zeros and zeros and zeros on it. So there's some things that were unique at that time. The anti-war movement was there. There was a lot of urban problem. But, you know, step back. That's not dissimilar to what we saw when we started the company. And within that dissatisfaction are the seeds of new opportunities to build some great business.
It's been a real inspiring few minutes getting a chance to say hello to you and hear from you firsthand. Thank you so much for sharing your stories and your wisdom with Business War listeners, Hap Klopp.
Well, thank you, David. It's my pleasure to be here.
From Wondery, this is Business Wars. Hey, we hope you enjoyed this episode. Coming up on our next series, we go inside the rivalry between Amazon and Walmart. This decades-long battle has transformed American life, changing the way we do almost everything. We'll tell you the story of these two behemoths as they race to grab market share from each other and change the face of e-commerce and big box stores forever. And hey, can't get enough of Business Wars? You know what to do. Scroll on over to Business Wars Daily. We'll keep you up to date on the most compelling competitions in commerce today in the time it takes to brush your teeth. And we invite you to subscribe to Business Wars Daily, or any other Wondery program on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, or wherever you're listening right now. You'll find a link on the episode notes of this program. You just tap or swipe over the cover art, and you'll also see some offers from our sponsors. We hope you'll support our show by supporting them. If you like what you've been listening to, we would love it if you give us a 5-star rating and tell your friends how to subscribe. Another way you can support us is by answering a short survey at wondery.com/survey. And don't forget to tell us what Business War stories you'd like to hear next. I'm your host, David Brown. Audrey Ngo produced this episode. Karen Lowe is our senior producer and editor. Emily Frost is our producer. Our executive producers are Jenny Lauer-Beckman and Marshall Louie. Created by Hernan Lopez, or Wondery.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.